During this virus, regimes spend the money they have on their people to fight the virus and not on illicit conduct.
But there is pressure on the United States to reduce sanctions during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's Wednesday, May 6th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also coming your way, some Asian nations are starting to see what might be the start of a return to normal. In one country, sports start a comeback. We'll explore what's happening to the relationship between the United States and China. That and more, all on today's VOA Asia. Human rights organizations, aid agencies, and former diplomats have called on the United States to ease sanctions on adversaries like Iran, Venezuela, and North Korea to facilitate medical and food assistance during the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Brian Padden reports that while supporters of President Donald Trump's maximum pressure strategy don't oppose humanitarian aid, they also don't want to provide any relief that might help authoritarian governments like North Korea hold on to power.
In North Korea, neither Kim Jong-un's return to public view after a long, unexplained absence, nor Pyongyang's dubious claims to have no coronavirus cases have eased growing concern that the pandemic is disrupting food supplies in a country already suffering from shortages. Advocates for tough sanctions on North Korea over its nuclear weapons program argue that providing coronavirus aid would allow authoritarian governments to spend more resources on weapons and illicit activities.
If during this virus our sanctions force behavioral change, in that the regimes spend the money they have on their people to fight the virus and not on illicit conduct, that's actually a good outcome for the United States and our national security.
While the pandemic may weaken America's adversaries, Washington is being urged by rights groups and others to balance the need to maintain pressure on authoritarian leaders with the growing humanitarian needs of people living under those regimes. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
While many nations, including the United States, continue to struggle, some find themselves starting to resume life somewhere near the way it was. Stay with us for that on VOA Asia. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. A Philippine government agency Tuesday ordered that country's leading broadcast network, which the president has targeted for its critical news coverage, to halt operations. Russian President Vladimir Putin has awarded Kim Jong-un a commemorative war medal marking the 75th anniversary of the victory over Nazi Germany, according to the Russian embassy in Pyongyang. Australia and New Zealand say that efforts to resume travel between them could take some time as they make cautious moves to reopen economies largely shuttered by the novel coronavirus. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. More than 4 million Australians have downloaded the government's COVID-safe tracing app, but officials insist many more need to sign on to make it effective. Australia has had 6,800 COVID-19 cases, 5,800 patients have recovered, and 95 people have died with the virus. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The COVID-safe app was launched in Australia just over a week ago. 4.25 million Australians have downloaded it, but officials say a greater uptake of the coronavirus tracing software would give political leaders the ability to be more bold in easing restrictions. The government has said about 10 million Australians, or 40% of the population, need to join the program to make it an effective tool to trace COVID-19 cases. Civil liberties groups say the technology breaches privacy, while some experts have questioned its ability to accurately trace users. But the Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, is urging more Australians to take part.
The other very important precondition that we've talked about on many occasions is the app. 4.25 million Australians have now downloaded the app, and clearly we need to keep downloads and registrations increasing. We think there are about 16 million adults with smartphones. They're our target population. They're the people we want to get to download the app because they're the people that are likely to be contacts of cases, and we want as many of them as possible to download the app.
The federal government says it will announce later in the week if more COVID-19 controls will be relaxed, following moves by some state and territory authorities to ease some public gathering and recreational restrictions. More than 630,000 tests have been carried out across the country. Australia also shut its borders to foreigners in March to stop the spread of imported cases of the disease. A New Zealand rugby team are the first foreign nationals to be allowed into Australia since international borders were closed. The New Zealand Warriors will stay in quarantine for 14 days before the planned resumption of the Australian National Rugby League on May 28. The Auckland-based Warriors are the only overseas side to play in the 16-team competition. In Sydney, another elderly resident has died at a care home that's become an epicentre for COVID-19 in Australia. 14 people have now died after a staff member caused an outbreak by working several shifts despite having mild coronavirus symptoms. The New South Wales state government said the situation at the facility was horrific and unacceptable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The number of coronavirus cases in South Korea continues a downward trend as that country restarts professional sports and prepares to open its schools. Charles Deledesma has more.
After reporting around 500 new cases daily in early March, infections have slowed over the past month amid tightened border controls and waning transmissions. Health authorities fear, though, a broader, quiet spread and plan antibody tests to learn how widespread the virus is. Meanwhile, officials have relaxed social distancing guidelines and will reopen schools in phased steps, starting with high school seniors on May 13. The Professional Baseball League has also begun its season, but with no fans in attendance. The Pro Soccer League also kicks off under similar conditions on Friday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Happening now in Asia, three Indian soldiers were killed in clashes with militants in the disputed Himalayan region of Kashmir, according to officials, a day after a gun battle in which five were killed. The flare-up comes amid a major offensive by India that has killed 22 militants over the past month. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. In recent weeks, the United States and China have sharpened their accusations over the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said this weekend that China hid the severity of the outbreak and did not allow any American investigators to study the virus early on. China insists it's been transparent and worked with the World Health Organization to prepare countries for the coming health disaster. We welcome to VOA Asia Jacques Delisle, Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, how do you read what's happening between the United States and China?
Well, I think it's another sharp negative turn in what has been a deteriorating trend in U.S.-China relations, and this is basically a provocative escalation.
Why?
Well, there is very little evidence to back up the theory that Pompeo alluded to. The notion that it is an intentional release or, worse yet, a man-made virus, there appears to be nothing to support that. Right after Pompeo made the statement you quoted, he was asked about whether he was taking issue with the findings of U.S. intelligence services, which believe it was not intentional. And believe the most likely explanation is the wet market explanation. This comes on the heels of a bunch of statements from the administration, including from the president, that have sought to blame China for the COVID-19 problems that the U.S. is now facing.
If you go back in news coverage of China, there was a time when it was reported that China was blaming the U.S. military. Did something possibly start there, or is this where it's beginning wider and wider as far as the rift between the two countries are concerned? And how much of this has to do with political reality, and how much does it have to do with reality?
Well, so far the evidence is it has more to do with politics than scientific reality. You alluded to a statement by a spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, which was quite extreme and as far as we can tell, completely unfounded statement. So what you see are these conspiracy theories circulating on both sides. That's part of the general context of U.S.-China relations these days. It's alarming to see it coming from official spokespeople on the Chinese side and from the Secretary of State, and something pretty close even from the President on the U.S. side. I think what we have is a situation here where China, its international reputation is suffering seriously from the way that COVID-19 has spread. That is an initial cover-up of information from China and a rather slow move to disclose and cooperate internationally, and an attempt to put a very good spin on it that basically isn't selling too well. And at the same time, the U.S. administration, which was very slow to respond and which has to deal with the consequences of a very serious outbreak, seeks to deflect blame toward China. So I think both sides are trying to duck blame for what has not been a very good job of handling a crisis, and they're blaming each other. That is the politics of the situation, and I think it is something that builds on what has long been a deteriorating U.S.-China relationship. It's been headed downhill for several years now, but this is an acceleration of the downhill spiral.
How much further do you expect this to continue escalating?
Well, hard to say. I mean, I think those who suggest that this could erupt into a serious international incident seems fairly far-fetched. I don't think either side has much of an appetite for seeking a confrontation that could lead to a serious international crisis. But this is something that does have some elements of a new Cold War. It's been strongly ideological. And I think if we don't see some attempts to sort of manage this and to take the temperature down a little bit, it gets in the way of areas where cooperation could still be possible and to climb down from what, again, has been a trend toward a much more fraught and conflict-oriented relationship.
Any further than the harsh words that Beijing has used for Pompeo's comments on Sunday, do you expect China to escalate as well?
I mean, I think we've seen a pattern of finger-pointing in both directions, so it could conceivably escalate. It's hard to know exactly what the next move beyond this would be in response to Pompeo narrowly. But if the U.S. does take steps like imposing trade sanctions or related economic sanctions, or in one of the more fanciful suggestions, it would be quite self-destructive to threaten not to pay on treasury bills on U.S. debt owned by China, which is very difficult route to pursue. If you get that sort of thing, I think you can see China pushing back. And I think if the rhetoric escalates, China will do more of what we've seen it already do, which is in the most extreme form suggest that the U.S. is somehow responsible. That's a fairly implausible claim for the origins of COVID. But I think we could easily see a sharpening of the rhetoric that says the U.S. is just trying to blame China for its own ineffective response. And you'll see China contrasting its relative success at containing the virus. And you'll see China, as it has been for the last several weeks now, trying to portray itself as a good global citizen, providing assistance, providing PPE and expertise and so on, while the U.S. has had a more nationalistic response. So I think this really is a game of each trying to portray the other as having botched the handling of the coronavirus at home and in the world.
Professor, I thank you so much for your time and information, and I thank you for speaking with us. This is VOA Asia.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Two pharmaceutical companies said Tuesday their experimental coronavirus vaccine is being delivered in the United States for initial human testing. U.S. drug maker Pfizer Incorporated and Germany's BioNTech SE said if the trials prove the vaccine is safe and effective, it could be ready for broad distribution in the United States by the end of the year. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Foreign workers such as Indians and Malaysians are chafing at new coronavirus lockdowns in Turkey, restricting not only their travel but their traditional observances of Ramadan. A holy month of fasting and contemplation for Muslims, foreign workers say the government and their employers, often one and the same, are keeping them from marking the holiday with family and loved ones. Turkey's mosques were among those devoid of worshippers as the holy month got underway amid unprecedented bans on family gatherings and mass prayers. A stunning emptiness enveloped the streets around sacred sites like the Blue Mosque, the most potent sign of how the daytime fasting month will be a somber affair across Muslim-majority nations. Some of these foreign workers, many of them from Southeast Asia, say they're being treated differently than Turkish workers, although the lockdowns affect both. Ramadan is typically a period of both worship and socializing, but this year strict lockdowns limit gatherings for iftar meals at dusk when the fast is broken, a centerpiece of Ramadan. However, some religious leaders in Asia, home to nearly a billion of the world's Muslims, have shrugged off fears about the spread of COVID-19. In Bangladesh, the fundamentalist Hefazat-e-Islam group criticized government moves to restrict access to more than 300,000 mosques nationwide. It's rush hour in Bangkok, home to its famous gridlock. With cars stationary, for some, two wheels are better than four. And today in Thailand, more and more women are kick-starting a new career. Hair pulled back tightly as she lounges on her red scooter, R is a rare sight among the male-dominated ranks of Bangkok's motor taxi riders plying their trade on the Thai capital's treacherous roads. A veteran of 7 years who works in the bustling Onnut district, R is among the thousands of women drawn to the work as gender roles in Thailand evolve, attracted by the flexible hours, decent wages, and a sense of autonomy.
There are accidents in the street, so it's a risky job. I'm not a nice girl. I'm a tough girl who likes to ride a motorcycle. That's why I'm doing this job. Business is good, with some riders pocketing up to $30 a day, almost double what they could earn in a factory.
Satranan says some men's physical looks may scare passengers, but when women work in this job, it makes for a softer image, not too tough as before. It's a dangerous job, with Thailand laying claim to one of the highest traffic death rates in the world. But there's no shortage of demand in the city of more than 10 million, where there's always someone looking for a ride home. That's Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman.
A message from your friends at VOA Asia. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month in the United States and comes as much of the world has been under lockdown to varying degrees for more than a month. As discussions in the United States take place on when to relax stay-at-home guidelines, other countries have already started the process. International Edition Steve Miller spoke with Stacey Henson, a licensed social worker and community outreach coordinator for the RecoveryVillage.com in Orlando, Florida. Henson discusses the psychological impact of self-isolation.
I think isolation can cause a number of, I guess, particular issues to increase or lessen for people. We've talked about the extrovert versus the introvert before, but when we look at isolation, we look at what has changed for people. How does that impact how they've typically lived their lives? And most of us get supports outside of the home. right? And when we look at Mental Health Awareness Month, we look at what's now absent that used to be present. So whether that's support groups, whether that's going to the therapist or your physician, whether that's accessing coping skills like going to the gym, right? Or going on walks and being social with friends. You know, there's things that have been removed from our normal day-to-day coping that I think is starting to have a compounded impact on us.
So what are the things that, you know, people are starting to face, and what challenges are they facing? And I guess, you know, what are some methods that they can use to overcome them?
Obviously, we look at the compounding mental health issues with that as well, but we look at the isolation causes potentially boredom. We see that people get bored. They aren't sure how to fill their time. Sometimes boredom leads to unhealthy habits or tapping into old habits that are not the best for us, whether that's looking at, you know, addiction type things, eating habits that may change, getting into family dynamics and emotional conflicts that may worsen the situation. We're looking at things just almost, I mean, I almost fueling the fire of whatever was there before. So we have the boredom factor. I mean, there's only so much screen time somebody can stand, right? And we look at how those components can be helpful. Getting that information in is tremendously helpful. Information is one of the things that can help people get through an isolative period like this, knowing what's going on, right? Because we're so disconnected in many ways, but we can stay connected through media, whether that's, you know, listening to programs like this, whether that's tapping into podcasts, whether that's reading the news, whether that's connecting with friends over Skype or Zoom or whatever, you know, whatever mechanism you use now. But on the same side, we look at if we get misinformation, if we're comparing ourselves to what, you know, the Smiths, quote unquote, are doing down the street, right? We're looking at that compounding piece of comparative negativity, I guess, where we look at, well, why aren't things going well for me? So we look at kind of that compounding piece. So boredom sets in. Do something different. Go back to what maybe you used to do before the screens were there, before we were stuck inside.
VOA Steve Miller speaking with Stacey Henson, a licensed social worker and community outreach coordinator for the RecoveryVillage.com in Orlando, Florida. Amid the growing number of Zoom, Skype, and other video interviews happening lately, a new form of entertainment has emerged, judging the interior of other people's homes. Tina Trin has more.
Until recently, Bruno Rulin worked at a bookstore in Berkeley, California. Forced to shelter in place because of the coronavirus, his attention has since turned to the books on other people's shelves, like actress Kate Blanchett's.
She had a big wall of books behind her, a really impressive scholarly university press history, and like that multi-volume OED, Oxford English Dictionary.
As more and more Americans rely on Zoom, Skype, and other video calling platforms to connect with the outside world, they're also opening their homes to armchair critics like Rulin.
Judging people by their books, which, you know, it's maybe not too fair, but I can't resist it.
Rulin's not alone.
We're, you know, spending perhaps an inordinate amount of time looking at these people's bookshelves and their living rooms or their kitchens.
Claude Taylor and his girlfriend decided to have some fun with it. They created Rate My Skype Room, a Twitter account that rates newsmakers' home interiors on a scale from 1 to 10.
One is just what we call the hostage video, just somebody appearing before a blank wall. With a scary expression. A 10 is the other extreme. Michael Benchloss, presidential historian, has just an amazing Skype room.
In just 3 weeks, Rate My Skype Room has amassed over 120,000 followers.
It's an unexpected intimacy that we are all participating in and enjoying.
As the pandemic continues to keep many at home, checking out the rooms where pundits, VIPs, and others are sitting has become a new form of entertainment.
Everyone is going through this collective experience alone but together. And I think this Room Raider thing is one way people have found to connect with each other while apart.
A welcome diversion during these unsettling times. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our managing director, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy your day.